Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump threatening Iran today, warning that they will have, quote, big problems if they resume their nuclear program, while Trump seems determined to blow up the P5+1 deal with Iran, which is preventing Iran from pursuing nuclear weapons. A veteran CIA operative and Middle East expert, Robert Baer, who is currently a national security analyst for CNN, joins us to discuss what exactly Trump may be threatening as he stood beside France's President Macron, who incidentally is trying to persuade Trump to stick with the Iran deal, which Trump characterized today as, quote, insane. With rumors rampant in the Middle East press about a buildup of U.S. naval and air forces in the eastern Mediterranean and the Gulf, we will assess the extent of the belligerent influence of the new National Security Advisor John Bolton, as well as warlike threats from Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu and Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, who are lobbying the White House to blunt Iran's growing influence in the region, particularly in Syria and in Iraq, where elections are about to take place with an Iranian-backed candidate, the frontrunner. Then we'll go to Canada and speak with Henry Giroux, the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest, whose most recent books are America at War with Itself and The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. He joins us to discuss yesterday's use of a van as a weapon in Toronto, which resulted in 10 killed and 14 wounded, mostly women. We'll try to understand the motives of the driver, Alec Manassian, who appears to be influenced by the so-called incel rebellion, and the fact that the suspect who taunted the police to shoot him is alive because the police in Canada are not trigger happy as they are here in the US. Then finally, we'll look into the increasingly tenuous state of Trump's nominee to head the Veterans Administration, Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson, who was elevated from his position as a White House physician by Trump to head up the second biggest government department after the Pentagon. Suzanne Gordon, an award-winning journalist and author of The Battle for Veterans Healthcare, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Policymaking and Patient Care, whose forthcoming book is Wounds of War, How the VA Delivers Health, Healing and Hope to the Nation's Veterans, joins us. We will discuss Trump's extraordinarily backhanded endorsement of his nominee today in a press conference in which Trump said he was standing by his nominee, while at the same time saying he did not want his nominee to go through an ugly process and be attacked by a, quote, vicious group of people, meaning the press, concluding with the nail in the coffin, if I were him, I wouldn't do it. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
And I know it's next to impossible to make sense of Donald Trump's mood swings and pronouncements and reversals shooting from the hip foreign policy. But what do you make of his threat today, standing beside Macron, of saying that if the U.S. did indeed pull out of the – he was asked if the U.S. pulls out of the P5+1 deal, won't that mean that Iran can go ahead with nuclear weapons, and which President Trump replied that they would have a big problem if they did that. So what do you make from that particular threat?
Well, Ian, I think it's pretty clear that Macron didn't convince him, at least up until now, to stay in that agreement. The problem with Trump is he doesn't realize that that agreement was never meant to deal with Iran's presence in Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq. That was never touched in the nuclear agreement. And he doesn't understand that the nuclear agreement, that part of it works. I mean, it's got an oversight and inspections which are intrusive, and it stopped the Iranians from making a nuclear bomb. It's widely supported around the world. I think he's conflating the two agreements. So it sounds to me that in May, he's not going to certify this agreement. For what reason, I don't know, because the inspector is saying it's working just fine. So he pulls out of the agreement, and Iran has more than hinted darkly that they're going to resume their nuclear weapons program, whether that means centrifuges or actually making a bomb, I can't tell you. And you have to combine that with what Iran is doing in Syria, and it's become a major player there. They keep on moving closer to the Golan Heights. The Israelis have been bombing them. Russia has threatened to give the Syrian surface-to-air missiles the S-300, which I believe would be a real serious danger to the Israeli Air Force. They couldn't, they couldn't control the air over Syria anymore. It's the logic of war, and it seems to me that Trump is doing nothing to stop this, and are pulling out of the nuclear agreement. I'm pretty sure the Iranians are going to react to this in a way that's going to give Israel a justification, give us a justification. But in any case, there's always the problem of escalation and unintended, unplanned war that I think should worry us all.
So what Trump said specifically was they're not going to be restarting anything. They restart it, they're going to have big problems, bigger than they've ever had before. Now, to answer your puzzlement over why he wants to pull out, I think if the deal was negotiated by Obama. Isn't that enough? I mean, Trump...
I think you're absolutely right. Just anything that Obama, any accomplishment he made, he's going to undo, whether it's EPA or Iran or...
Or Cuba. The amazing thing in Cuba is that a conservative, if that's what Donald Trump is, or at least a Republican, is stopping the progress towards a market economy in Cuba. Go figure. But what do you make, Robert Baer, of the rumors in Middle Eastern press now about, and I've heard elsewhere as well, about a U.S. military buildup in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Gulf with warships and aircraft gathering?
I've been hearing that they're putting in logistics. This is for the last, it's been for a while. It's not recent. It could have picked up. But I think that if he plans to pull out in May and you have elections in Iraq, which could worsen things, in tensions in Syria, that there are preparations for a conflict. This could be routine exercises, but I think, like I said, it's the logic of war. I mean, it's not going to happen tomorrow, but nobody is offering diplomacy in any of this. I mean, it's just like they have it in Syria. We're going to take them on, and you also have to look at John Bolton, who looks at Iran as our main enemy, and as its hegemony in the Middle East is a threat to the United States, is a threat to Israel, it's a threat to Saudi Arabia. And on the Iranian side, by the way, you've got them. I mean, they're preparing for a war, too. They have been filming inside their caves where they keep missiles. And the idea is that should a war start, they can pull these missiles out, drive them out, fire them within minutes. They're solid fuel rockets. And they could hit an enormous amount of targets, including Israel, I believe, and definitely hit the oil facilities in the Gulf. So they're expecting something to happen, too. This is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps that mans most of these missiles. And so the fact that they're filming down in there and making these films public is sort of a warning to us. Yeah, well, we're ready to go to war, too. So, the rhetoric on each side is not good. And if we do pull out of the nuclear agreement, it's going to undermine Rouhani, who said, let's go. I mean, this is going to work eventually. The economy is going to get better and so forth. So the Iranians, especially the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, are going to become more ascendant in Iran.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassination. So I understand that these underground missile silos A lot of them are just on the north side of the Gulf, aimed at the Saudi oil fields. We know that the Saudi Crown Prince and Prime Minister Netanyahu have been pushing for the U.S. to get into a military conflict with Iran. And it's extraordinary to think that the U.S. could be suckered into a war at the behest of Israel and Saudi, that American boys and girls would die at the behest of Netanyahu and MBS, but that appears to be the case. So do you think the May 12 deadline, which is I think when Trump is likely to pull out of the P5+1, that is where the clock is ticking towards? Because that's why, in large part, Macron is over here. He's trying to convince Trump.
Well, they're terrified. Exactly. I mean, they're terrified. I mean, the good thing about Trump is he threatens war like he did against North Korea and at the last minute walks back. Mm-hmm. You know, the fire and fury thing, and that's what we're really hoping for, is that he doesn't push. He boasts. And I don't think he can remember his arguments from one day to the next. Here's the problem with the guy. As we know, he's on the telephone now talking to his buddies and, you know, around the United States, informal advisors.
On an unsecure phone, by the way.
On an unsecure phone. And they're saying, look, Iran, you know, it's threatening Saudi Arabia. It's threatening Israel. You can't let this happen. You have to stand up to this guy. So the thing about he may change his mind by tomorrow and come to an agreement with the French and Europe and the Russians to, you know, keep the nuclear agreement in place. You know, I just don't know. Like you said at the beginning, it's hard to tell what goes through his mind. I think he's got ADD, and he is truly a populist, and he just, you know, he's got this sense of what Americans fear and what seizes them at the moment, and that seizes him at the same time. And that's why he was elected president.
Well, he probably will sort of make some vague announcement after Macron leaves and wait for Angela Merkel to show up at the White House on Friday, because she's coming as well to urge him not to pull out of the P5+1. And so presumably after he's met with Merkel, we'll know. But if you compare this to the North Korean deal, where he was incredibly belligerent, and now he's praising the North Koreans. He praised Kim Jong-un today, saying that the guy was, honest and straightforward and wonderful, and we're making great progress to denuclearize, whatever that means, the peninsula.
Well, first of all, I mean, the North Koreans haven't even promised that. They've just said they're going to suspend their tests.
Right.
They're probably suspending to rearm, if I know them.
Well, they're suspending closing the test site, because apparently the last explosion just about collapsed the mountain, and that they can't test anymore without the mountain collapsing. So that's a practical
reason.
It's
amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. So this is where I wonder, who's out there to try and stop this madness? With Bolton whispering in Trump's ear, with Netanyahu whispering in the other ear, with MBS throwing money at the relatives and trying to push for a war with Iran. And you've pointed out, if anything happens, missiles will rain down on the Saudi Arabian oil terminals across the Gulf. So that'll be a catastrophe for the global economy. The only beneficiary, as far as I could tell, of a shutdown of Middle East oil would be Putin. The price of oil would go through the roof. So who's talking sense and restraint apart from General Mattis?
Just General Mattis. I think that's it. I mean, we don't have Secretary of State. We know that Pompeo, if he's confirmed, would like to go after the Iranians. There's nobody at the Central Intelligence Agency. Bolton is going to, whatever the CIA comes up with, he's going to ignore it. He's got his own sources. And so it's Mattis, and the military is basically saying, we do not have the troops to go into a war, a regional war in the Middle East. We just don't have the troops. We don't have logistics. We don't have enough airplanes, ammunition, and the rest of it. And if it got out of hand, it would take us, you know, a year to get up to speed, you know. And a war like that, the military knows, could spin out of control at any moment. You know, the amount of damage and when the missiles start flying, and let's not forget Hezbollah. They've got tens of thousands of missiles that they'll rain down on Haifa and Tel Aviv. And I don't think the Israeli defenses can stop them all. So if Haifa is burning, I just don't see Bibi Netanyahu saying, well, you know, there will be losses. He'll have to move into Lebanon, which is a whole nother war, and he's going to look for support. He just can't fight a war. The Israelis can't fight a war in Syria and Lebanon against Hezbollah and Iran. That would strain them. I could throw just nightmare scenarios one after another. What I'm trying to say is we're not prepared to go to war with Iran. So I hope that Trump walks this back.
Well, we know that Mattis walked Trump and Bolton back from a bigger strike on Syria. He didn't even want to do anything, from what I can tell. And then Trump did an end run around him by tweeting out that our beautiful missiles will be on their way soon. So he felt he had to do something, and they made the most minimal strike that was entirely cosmetic against empty buildings.
Which bolstered the regime of Bashar al-Assad and the Iranians, because
right. The
message was, we're not going to touch the regime. And those buildings, they used to make sarin gas, were pretty much empty. And that's not to mention a warning was given, you know, days ahead of time, clear those places out. And the fact that they didn't hit the royal not the royal palace, but Bashar's palace above Damascus, which would have been a sign we're going to come after the regime. So the Syrians that I talked to in the regime were absolutely delighted, because they thought the worst was going to happen. And now they're saying, hey, you know, it was almost for them a sign of support.
But it's a different matter if Iran starts firing long-range missiles at the Saudi oil facilities and at Israel itself. I don't know whether you get to the nuclear threshold, but that surely has to be considered.
Well, if those missiles work as advertised by the Iranians, they can take out, Ras Tanura, Abqaiq, and I go right down the line, and take out, 30% of the world's exported oil for a long time. I mean, it's for a long time, which I don't think anybody's run the numbers on this, but we're talking, I don't know, I always throw it out, and it's just a total guess, $10, $15 for a gallon of gas in the panic. Nobody knows what it would be. That would push us, of course, into a recession. A major recession or a depression, that kind of oil prices. So, I mean, that's another nightmare scenario. They're never as bad as the nightmare looks, but it's certainly with the realm of possibility, that kind of disaster. So a war with Iran is not going to be localized. And the people who say, well, we're a major oil producer now, but the point is oil is a world market. And it's like anything else, it will just shoot up, including this country. But again, somebody, I hope, whether it's somebody in the White House, and I don't know who's left, will sit Trump down and explain to him, if the Iranians start open another centrifuge and you decide to make a stand there and blow it up, we don't know whether they're going to open up on Saudi Arabia and UAE. I think they probably would, but it beats one hell of a risk.
Well, that's the problem with the Iranians. It's the Ayatollahs and Quds and the Ayatollahs that are the crazy ones, but they're in control. And you got, a reasonable guy, it seems, in Rouhani, but everything we do that's belligerent undercuts him. And I don't know that he has much influence and power. I mean,
he would be, that kind of a, he's a completely undercut. And then we'd be dealing with the hardliners, the same ones we dealt with in 79. We're more than willing to go to war with the United States when they took over our embassy. That's the same mentality, the mullahs, as Iranians, secular Iranians look at them. The mullahs will have their day.
Well,
it's not good, Ian.
Listen, everything you've said is a nightmare. I mean, it's crazy. There's no upside anywhere. Not that there ever is starting wars. We should have learned that from the Iraq War. But Trump is definitely obsessed with his problems on the home front. He seems to be quite aggressive. He's just personally ordered that Jeff Sessions hire this Ezra Cohen Watnick, the guy that they fired from the National Security Council.
National Security Advisor. Yeah, yeah. He's another hardliner.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a grasp on government. I mean, It's like anybody who doesn't understand international relations, and you drop them into that position at that age with those biases and some sort of dementia on his part. You have to wonder. And you throw all these crises at him, and you know, the possibility of impeachment and war and the rest of it. Most of us wouldn't do well. And you know, in all fairness, he didn't create the problem in Iraq and Syria. But now it's at his front doorstep, and he doesn't know the difference between a Shia and a Sunni and an Alawite. Well, you know, and also, I mean, I spent my entire life at this, and I still learn something every day.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Robert Baer. As grim as
that,
the prospect is.
Right. Well, that's the worst case scenario, and let's keep our fingers crossed.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who is one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And he's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. So we're going to take a brief station break, and we're back and go to Canada and speak with Henry Giroux about the massacre of mostly women on the streets of Toronto by a person with very strange motives.
Come, you masters of war, here that build the big guns, here that build the death planes, here that build all the bombs, here that hide behind walls, here that hide behind discs. I just don't want you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Canada is Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University. He writes regularly for Truthout, and his most recent books include Dangerous Thinking in the Age of New Authoritarianism, Disposable Futures, Violence in the Age of the Spectacle, America at War with Itself, and his latest book is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Oh, hi, Ian. Good to be back.
Well, I wish the conversation were about something else, not that our previous conversations are exactly full of light and joy when we talk about the Trump administration and creeping fascism in the United States. But what seems to have happened in Toronto is quite a mystery, where this fellow Alex Manassian drove a rented van, used it as a weapon, killed 10 people and wounded 14, mostly women, on the streets of Toronto, which is not far from where you are. And from what we can tell, he's been influenced by this so-called incel rebellion, which seems to be the strangest. And he's praised the young man who shot up a bunch of fellow students at the University of Santa Barbara, University of California in Santa Barbara here, a while back. So what do you know about this strange idea of celibacy, a rebellion of men who...
It certainly is strange, but I think it's just an expression, distorted and bizarre as it is, of a kind of misogyny that is so rampant in the culture, you know, coupled with a propensity to exhibit violence against women, that in some ways, I don't want to say we shouldn't be surprised by it, but I think that when you have a culture that's so addicted to violence and so addicted to the endless demonization of everything from undocumented immigrants to teachers, to poor people, but especially in light of the Me Too movement, which, you know, all of a sudden women have now found their voice in being able to make visible the kind of violence waged against them. Couple that with the ultra-nationalism and the kind of white supremacy that we've seen emerging and gaining enormous visibility under the Trump administration. This stuff travels. I mean, you know, national boundaries don't, in a sense, contain this anymore. So this addiction to violence, this notion that the way in which culture cultivates values and eroticizes and accepts violence and fuels the culture of violence, you're going to get people like this who buy into this stuff, who can't see and even imagine any other alternative to the kind of alienation, the kind of insecurity, the precarity, the loneliness that they experience. I mean, I don't find this unusual. I find it tragic and sad, and I unfortunately think we're going to see more of this as time goes on.
So this,
in the next 2 or 3 years.
So this strange incel rebellion, I just wanted to try and get some kind of handle on it because I really don't know much about it. I do recall that the young man who killed those fellow students at UC Santa Barbara, Elliot Roger, was very bitter about the fact that he had no relationship with women and kind of was angry at women because
no, that's the nature of the rebellion. These are people who claim that they're basically involuntarily celibate, and that people who are relatively good looking, they call them Chads and Stacys, relatively good looking men and women who have access to each other, are causing them all kinds of problems. But the focus of the anger seems to be aimed particularly at the women who somehow are rejecting them and causing them extreme anxiety, unpleasantness, and in this particular case, the urge to actually attack women and take revenge on them. It's one of the weirdest groups, I've ever come across. I mean, the notion that attractive men and women are causing them to be involuntarily celibate, only in a society that's gone insane, it seems to me, at some level, can this stuff gain any legitimacy or converts.
So these guys don't understand that the reason women don't want to date them is that they're creeps. So they just go out and kill women because they're rejected? I mean,
I think what they tend to think is that, you know, the only expression of manhood that matters, the only element of attractiveness that seems to matter as an aesthetic that's worth thinking about, is basically a kind of hyped, unapologetic, unfettered masculinity, which needs to be displayed, and that those who are vulnerable are viewed as disposable, weakness is seen as humiliating and the object of derision, and violence becomes a code for reinforcing what in fact is now what I would call a sense of national lawlessness. So, I mean, they actually, in light of that argument, this ongoing fueling of the culture of militarism, they see themselves as being subjects who are derided because they don't have the strength, the looks, the heightened masculinity that, you know, is being celebrated in the culture. So they in turn use its tools to go out and basically avenge that sense of inadequacy. That certainly seems to be the case in terms of this guy's interaction with social media.
And again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds McMaster University Professor for scholarship in the public interest and is the distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University. He writes regularly for Truthout, and his most recent books include Dangerous Thinking in the Age of New Authoritarianism, Disposable Futures, Violence in the Age of the Spectacle, America at War with Itself, and his latest book is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. He joins us from Canada, where yesterday a white rider van driven by Alec Manassian mowed down, killed 10 people and wounded 14, mostly women, on the streets of a very multicultural and peaceful city, Toronto. Also happens to be where all the G7 foreign ministers are gathering. It's pretty hard to understand how this guy was able to drive for a whole kilometer down these pedestrian streets and do what he did. But I thought the one thing that was very striking to me, Henry, was that when they finally, the police finally caught up to this guy and the van was kind of wrecked, he came out of the van and then kept pointing an object at them as though he had a gun and seemed to be taunting them to shoot him. But the Toronto police did not shoot him. They, you know, basically arrested him. And boy, I think if that would have happened in the U.S., that guy would have been riddled with bullets.
Oh, he would have had 50 bullets in him. Are you kidding? I mean, you know, state violence in the United States is not even an afterthought. Here, I mean, at least in Toronto, it seems to me that the police are more actually they're really trained in ways to confront these kind of expeditious and violent kinds of situations. I mean, clearly, there are also problems with the Toronto police and other police forces in Canada, but it's a more civilized country, I think, around that issue. You know, there really is an attempt to believe that words matter and that you can talk people through something and the first response doesn't have to be like the Wild West of America, you know, pull out your gun and shoot somebody and then parade around as if you've achieved the status of John Wayne. But I also think there's something else. You know, I guess I have a book coming out in a few days called American Nightmare, you know, facing the challenge of fascism. And I think we really need to talk more systemically about the addiction to violence in the United States and the way in which governance has literally collapsed in such a way that it's now run by corrupt bankers and corrupt politicians and the financial elite, and how the sense of lawlessness has now is being legitimated at such the highest level of government. I mean, when the President of the United States tells police chiefs not to treat people who are suspects kindly, treat them as thugs and bang their heads against the roof of the car as they're putting them into the police car, you know, you begin to get a sense of that something has gone terribly wrong, that we've crossed over into the abyss, that violence now becomes the only form of mediation by which to address a whole range of social problems and foreign policy, so that you get you've got somebody who's constantly plays the role of the schoolyard bully. The only language he knows is the language of friend, enemy. Questions of moral responsibility are thrown out the window. Questions of justice are thrown out the window. The only thing that really seems to matter is the culture of fear, terror, and corruption. And, is it any wonder that in the face of this, more and more people become not only unsettled, but literally believe that form of lawlessness has become so normalized that they can engage in it? That's fascism. I mean, that's a fascist culture.
So how do you see this particular peculiar aberration of involuntary celibacy from a bunch of frustrated men who blame women for their lack of ability to engage in some kind of relationship short of even having sex? I mean, you see it more of the kind of sad collateral damage of a kind of macho male culture where you have these movies starring The Rock where everybody's ripped with muscles and throw cars in the air and do all kinds of stunts and stuff like that.
I don't want to overemphasize the Rambo culture. I think that's part of it, and I think it's important. But I think that we're facing something else in the United States. Leo Lowenstein, the great critical theorist, talked about it once right after the war, right after, of course, the Second World War, when he was in the United States, and he said, what capitalism produces is what he calls, you know, social atomization, the atomization of people. You know, people are cut off. They're lonely. You know, you live in a country that operates off a kind of ruthless economic Darwinism that seems to suggest that self-interest is the only thing that matters, that promotes a kind of competitive atmosphere in which people are at each other's throat, so only one person left on the island. I mean, you know, where are the cultures of compassion? But more importantly, Ian, where are the public spheres that educate people to basically engage in shared responsibilities, to take to learn something about what it means to be ethically and morally responsible, not to you simply yourself, but to the commons, to the good of society. What happens when the language of community and democracy so withers that the only language that's left is the language of the isolated, unstable, and anxious self? That's a serious problem, and I think that until these countries begin to address where this kind of ruthless neoliberalism has gone, and eliminating all those places where people can meet, talk, engage in dialogue, you know, produce public spheres that in some way support the public good, provide social safety nets for people, you're going to see a lot more of this behavior.
Well, just in closing, it would seem that also the influence of Silicon Valley on our culture, the tech culture, the atomization of people staring at the devices in their palms and not looking at the people opposite them, whether families at the dinner table, people sitting at restaurants, or young people, communicating with each other. They communicate more with their devices and in that kind of vicarious world of in social media of wanting to be like the Kardashians and living a kind of life through the tawdry celebrities of these reality TV stars like the Kardashians and the President of the United States, I might say.
And lifestyle politics. And at the same time, a technology that, sets the ground for dehumanizing people and alienating them because it disembodies them. I don't know what it means to talk about a community if a community only means that you hit a like button or you hit a friend button. That sounds absurd to me. And I think that to the degree that communities disappear and all of a sudden become virtually virtual and nothing else, you set the ground for a kind of a culture in which the worst can happen, in which it's easy to dehumanize, it's easy to demonize, it's impossible to engage in acts of solidarity. What we're really talking about here with this technology is a major contributing factor to the demise of the social. Now, I don't want to overemphasize that, and I know you're not either, because it also can be used for a whole range of politically progressive purposes. But I think the larger culture, the values of privatization, deregulation, commodification, lifestyle politics, they override how that technology can be used in such a powerful way that you get a culture of immediacy and you end up with a culture of selfies. You know, I was reading today about the emergence of what they call cuddle clubs. You know, people are now starting businesses where they cuddle other human beings and charge money to do it. I mean, that borders on insanity. And you think, wow, you know, are people so lonely that they would pay to simply have another person simply touch them? I mean, a kind of striking indication, a kind of signpost of the abyss that people find themselves in a culture where actually the murder of children is not as important as the NRA and the corporate giants making a profit on selling violence. I mean, because that's what it comes down to in the end. It comes down to laws of governance that are no longer rooted in any sense of democratic values.
Well, Henry Giroux, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, my pleasure, Ian. Always a pleasure with you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, who's a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University. He writes regularly for Truth Out, and his most recent books include Dangerous Thinking in the Age of New Authoritarianism, Disposable Futures, Violence in the Age of Spectacle, America at War with Itself, and his latest book is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. And he joined us from Canada. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the increasingly tenuous state of Trump's nominee to head the Veterans Administration. Welcome back. I'm Ian Marcus, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Suzanne Gordon, an award-winning journalist and author who has written for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, and the American Prospect, among others. She is the author of The Battle for Veterans Healthcare, Dispatches from the Frontlines of Policymaking and Patient Care, and her forthcoming book is Wounds of War, How the VA Delivers Health, Healing, and Hope to the Nation's Veterans. Welcome to Background Briefing, Suzanne Gordon.
Thanks for having me in.
Well, thank you for joining us, Suzanne. And the Senate confirmation hearings scheduled for Thursday for Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson to head up the VA have been postponed. But the most extraordinary press conference took place today after we had a photo opportunity with President Trump and the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, and after brushing dandruff off Macron's shoulders, Trump was asked about the fate of his nominee, who was the former White House physician, Admiral Ronnie Jackson, and he went into the most peculiar backhanded endorsement by saying he was standing by his nominee, while at the same time he said that he didn't want this nominee to go through an ugly process and be attacked by, quote, a vicious group of people, meaning the press. And he concluded with the nail in the coffin, saying, if I were him, if I were Ronnie Jackson, I wouldn't do it. So what did you make of that?
What can I say, Ian? I think that Trump, first of all, Trump fired David Shulkin in his traditional way. David Shulkin was the former secretary of the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs, who Trump, who got a unanimous approval from the Senate, and Trump was always boasting about that. Shulkin was the undersecretary for health under President Obama, and there were some questionable things that he did, although he claims, and there's some talk that he was really fired because he opposed privatization fast as opposed to what he was pushing and what many in the Senate and Congress are pushing, which is privatization slow of the VA. And then Trump picked someone who is completely unqualified for the job without apparently doing any vetting. And let's remember here, Ronnie, Ian, that Ronnie should remember this too, that, you know, to vet Ronnie Jackson, Jackson has spent his almost entire career in the White House. So if you want, if the White House wants to vet him, it's not like the White House has to do much except walk down the hall and ask some questions. It's not like the White House has to go over to another governmental agency or another private corporation. Basically they apparently didn't do any due diligence, and now we're discovering what some senators on both sides of the aisles are saying are alarming reports of overprescription of medication, drinking on the job, creating a hostile work environment. It will be quite interesting to see what actually comes out. And people said these are serious allegations, not just episodes, and that they indicate a pattern of problematic behavior. I mean, you know, President Trump claims that he's a great friend of veterans, and I think it's every veteran in America should be insulted by the fact that the president would take as someone like Jackson, whatever his record. I mean, even if this, even if these allegations weren't true, he was a Navy doctor. He was in the battlefield briefly, and I'm sure he acted in a very admirable manner in Iraq. But his whole career as a physician has, most of his career as a physician has been spent in the rarefied atmosphere of the small White House Physician Corps. And since 2013, he was the president's physician, which made it even more rarefied. So he's no administrative experience, no experience of the kind of complex patients that are served by the nation's largest and only publicly funded integrated healthcare system, the VA, and no qualifications for the job. Any VA physician is more qualified for the job than Ronnie Jackson.
Well, the job involves administering 360,000 employees and has an annual budget of $186 billion. It's the second biggest government department after the Pentagon. So it's no small undertaking. But what I find particularly ironic, Suzanne Gordon, is that the president, of course, attacked the press as being a bunch of vicious people destroying this poor man. But it's Trump who's destroyed him. He's put him up for a nomination for which he's not qualified, and he's hung him out to dry. And now he's going to be piled on, and he's got have to take the humiliating step at some point or other of just throwing in the towel.
Well, and then one wonders if he will remain in the White House. I mean,
exactly.
You know, will he keep this cushy little job of White House physician, which I'm sure is quite a cushy job, and I mean, his reputation will not be very well served by this. But, you know, I mean, one has to ask oneself what kind of judgment someone like this has. Again, if he has some skeletons in the closets, his judgment is even poorer. But I have a friend who's a VA physician who had a very similar trajectory, Navy physician in the first Gulf War. But my friend has had significant, administrative experience in a hospital, not in the second largest agency in the U.S. government. He said if he were asked by the president to, you know, be the secretary of the VA, he'd say, "Are you crazy?" And he's more qualified than Jackson, particularly since he works in the VA and knows VA patients. But the thing is, Jackson, even before this happened, one had to question somebody like his judgment, that it's either terrible judgment or, you know, incredible medical hubris or military hubris or some kind of hubris that he would even say yes. And, of course, now I imagine he's regretting it. But you know, Ian, I mean, I think the real tragedy here is that all of this is obscuring the real question that the VA is facing and that we are, as a nation, are facing, which is what is the future of the VA? I mean, as we speak, you know, not only is the Senate and the House, or this particularly Senate, looking into Jackson's record, but, you know, there are several very serious bills that really hold the fate of the VA in their hands, the Veterans Health Administration, that is. And we have to be looking at that, and immediately before this came out, John Tester of Montana commented that Jackson said he was against privatization. He had the same stance on privatization as Shulkin did. He may have the same stance on privatization that, sadly, Democrat John Tester has, which is basically he's the co-author of a bill, Senate Bill 2193, that really should be opposed by anyone interested in the fate of the nation's veterans or in American healthcare, because this would slowly but surely privatize the VA in the name of giving veterans choice to go into a private sector that is actually not at all ready to serve their complex needs.
And again, I'm speaking with Suzanne Gordon, who's an award-winning journalist and author who has written for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, and the American Prospect, among others. She's the author of The Battle for Veterans Healthcare, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Policymaking and Patient Care, and her forthcoming book is Wounds of War, How the VA Delivers Health, Healing, and Hope to the Nation's Veterans. So let's talk about these privatization efforts, because I'm pretty sure at the end of the day that's what this is all about. And I think they probably thought with Jackson, he's just a guy like Dr. Carson at HUD. He doesn't know a damn thing about anything except brain surgery. Here he is giving loans to Sean Hannity and running an agency that's supposed to be all about providing low-income people with housing, not helping a multimillionaire increase his $100 million real estate portfolio. But that's what we have in this country, and particularly under Republican administrations, we have a form of right-wing welfare. But my understanding is that the people really pushing this privatization of the VA, because there's so much money to be stolen, is the Koch brothers front group that they put up. Aren't they pushing this?
Absolutely. You have groups like the Koch brothers Concerned Veterans for America. You have a partially funded group, Pacific Institute, I think it's Pacific Research Institute, which consistently attacks the VA and uses it as a poster child to try to defeat single-payer health care. You have a whole bunch of hospitals and drug companies and so forth that see huge pot of gold in the VA. And, you know, the tragedy is that the Koch brothers are yes, and these conservative funders are behind it, but it's really the mainstream media that has pushed the story, the Koch brothers' narrative, that the VA is broken beyond repair, and it's the New York Times, the LA Times, and, you know, the Boston Globe and the Washington Post that just put, you know, publish story after story after story, negative story after story after story, and fail utterly to cover any of the innovations and significant research and innovations in patient care that the VA has pioneered. And it's really sad because even some of my most progressive and liberal friends believe the purple Kool-Aid that the VA is a terrible place, and nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, I wish I could get the kind of health care that some of the veterans I know get on a daily basis.
So what then is going to turn, if you've got John Tester, a Democratic senator, basically fronting, I don't know whether he's fronting for the Koch brothers.
No, he's not fronting for the Koch brothers, but he is. It's a very difficult situation. The Democrats are, you know, I don't know, they want to show that they're bipartisan. They don't really understand that, you know, the strategy, in my view, should be stall until November 2018, see what kind of Congress we get, and, you know, try to keep these bills from going through because you might get better bills. And they, you know, get some Republican allies, which is potentially possible, get the veteran service organizations. Sadly, the many veteran service organizations are, you know, caught in the clutches of the notion that, you know, they can only get a bad deal out of this government, and so they should try to get some crumbs. And I think that's a mistake, too. And I think people should be trying to get bills out of the House and Senate that fully fund the VA. Bernie Sanders proposed such a bill in 2014. That bill should be reinvigorated and reintroduced, you know, because that was a real improve the VA bill that gave veterans what they need, not taking things that they need away from them.
Well, but who can speak up here? I mean, can the veterans speak up? Are there veterans organizations that know about what's happening?
Yeah, there are great veterans organizations, and I think, you know, some of the traditional VSOs have spoken up, but I think they're not, you know, they are caught in the kind of inside the beltwayism where they think they have to be at the table and they have to be moderate and so forth. But, you know, there's many groups. There's Veterans for Peace. There's a group that I've spoken on their panels called Fighting for Veterans Healthcare. There's Swords to Plowshares in San Francisco. And, you know, the other thing is this is not just a veterans issue. I mean, I think, you know, I don't have any veterans in my family. My daughter briefly worked as a nurse practitioner for the VA. But you don't have to be a veteran to pick up the phone and call your congressperson in L.A. or San Francisco or your senator. You know, the Democrats are very wobbly. And if you have a Republican congressman, they're supposed to be on the side of veterans. And I think every single one of us, I mean, I do it regularly, pick up the phone and call, you know, it takes 5 minutes to look their name up online and call their office and say, you know, we don't like Bill 2193. We don't like House Bill, House Resolution 4242 or 4243. I believe it's 4243. And we aren't for VA privatization. And, you know, they all say they're not for privatization, but what they mean by privatization is selling off everything in the VA tomorrow. But privatization in this country is not that. It's the slow starving of the public sector and the transfer of money from the public sector to the private sector. In the case of the VA, it's starving the VA of needed resources and staff, outsourcing, sending veterans through what's called choice to the private sector, and not fixing the problems that there are in the VA. And I think every single person who's listening to this show, if they care about American health care and they care about veterans, and we should all care about veterans. I mean, I don't like the wars in which they fought, but, you know, these people were working for us. They think they made us safer. I don't think they did, but they do, some of them don't. And I think that, you know, they have made sacrifices. They were promised benefits that they're not going to be getting if we privatize. And if the veterans healthcare system, which is the only socialized medicine system in this country, the only really public healthcare system in this country, is privatized, what hope do we have of getting real healthcare reform
that
you and I need?
Exactly. Single payer. Well, of course, that's the Koch brothers' subtext to destroy the very notion of single payer. So the example can't be shown to the American people, who have no idea what a lousy healthcare system they have. I thank you for joining us, Suzanne Gordon.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Suzanne Gordon, an award-winning journalist and author who has written for The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and The American Prospect, among others. She is the author of The Battle for Veterans Healthcare, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Policymaking and Patient Care. And her forthcoming book is Wounds of War, How the VA Delivers Health, Healing, and Hope to the nation's veterans. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.